Hello, it is June 10th, 2015. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 5.11, 511, if you will, of the Will Leach Experience podcast on sports on earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. Special podcast for you this week in the middle of the week. I have to give it to you because there's no baseball podcast next week with Allison Futter. I thought we were going to be able to schedule, but we won't be. She's traveling, I'm traveling. So this is going to have to hold you off for a week and a half. But it's a great one. I'm very excited to have, as my guest today, Shane Ryan. He's a writer for Grantland and for Paste, among other places. He's the author of the new book, Slaying the Tiger, which is out in bookstores right now. You can also order it from Amazon or other less evil booksellers. It's called Slaying the Tiger. It's about a year on the PGA Tour, looking at young, up-and-coming golfers like Jordan Spieth or Spieth or Spoth or Spath or Spurth. However he is these days, Bubba Watson, Ricky Fowler, of course, Rory McIlroy, and you may have heard something a little bit about his kerfuffle with Patrick Reed. We're going to discuss all of that and golf. Shane Ryan, this is a great Father's Day book. Father's Day is coming up. I am not your father, at least as far as I know, so a golf book is not the best book for me for Father's Day, A, because I don't really like golf that much, and B, I already have the book. I've read it. I'm interviewing the author right now, so do not get me this book for Father's Day. But you should get it for your own father, or get it for yourself if your children are too young to buy books or use the internet. For the record, all children are too young to use the internet. Anyway, here's Shane Ryan. Read the book. The book is Slaying the Tiger. Buy it, read it, enjoy the book and this podcast. All right, Shane, first off, thank you for coming on in the midst of a publicity blitz. It is this podcast will go up the day after your book has gone on sale. So I assume this is your first book of this scale. What are you going to book? I always had a hard time with this when books first came out, to stare at the Amazon number or to go by bookstores or to do all of those things. How are you keeping yourself sane for these first 24 hours or so?
Yeah, I think I've completely given up on sanity. I just exist in a constant state of anxiety, and I feel like my whole future is sort of on the line. So it's a really fun place to be. But no, you know, in truth, Will, I'm really excited. It is my first book. It's I think I've gotten to the point. There's so much time, as you know, between when you finish the book and when it publishes, that I actually feel like I've come full circle and sort of gotten back to the point where now I'm just sort of grateful that this all happened.
Yeah, it's funny too, because and the best advice I can give people on this, because I've never had I've written some books, but nothing, no like blow up huge bestseller. But the best thing I'm maybe not the best example of this, but from my friends that publish book, the thing I always try to remind people when they're doing their first book is, in a week from now, you will still be the same person that you were a week ago and you are right now. Because I remember having that thought as well. I was like, oh, when I'm a published author, I will walk down the street and the sidewalks will clear. And they'll be like, here he is, published author man. And you have a book party, or if you have a book party, or just a book dinner or so on, that happens. And then you're just a regular guy checking his Amazon numbers and on Twitter, getting in fights with people on Twitter like everybody else.
So. Yeah, it's funny. I think there was a point during which I was writing it when I thought, yeah, this was, I just kind of assumed it would be a bestseller. For some reason, that was in my head. And now the sort of reality of the book publishing world has hit me. And so I'm coming back to the thing of like, okay, there is life after the release date. You're going to have to continue writing. You're not going to retire at age 32.
Right. One of my favorite things my relatives would always do I have a book come out, and they'd be like, well, have you sent it to Oprah? That's always the first thing they ask if you've sent it to Oprah. And on one end, I want to find it funny. You know, listen, it's charming. Like, our lives have very little in common. So it's this kind of nice way that, like, I get what they're doing, and they're trying to engage to this thing that I do that they don't really care about. On the other hand, they're still kind of depressing that, like, this is still happening now, and Oprah's not been in this book club in like a long time. But there's also this idea that that is actually how the average person relates to books. Like, oh, those are those things that Oprah liked.
Yeah, right. It's not a familiar object anymore. It's a thing endorsed by a celebrity.
Exactly.
I'm going to, what I'm going to do is preemptively refuse Oprah's book club, like Jonathan Franzen, without being asked. But if anybody wants to make a big deal of that and promote the book, please feel free.
Listen, you cannot be a party to the coarsening of American letters.
Okay? Absolutely,
like,
no.
Like that woman with her, you know, her Song of Solomon, all these wonderful books that she completely promoted.
The Color Purple, awful.
Like this total ass. ass bag. Anyway, okay, so and a wonderful writer, by the way, but still, I think by all accounts, an ass bag. All right, we should probably talk about your book. So you spent last year following. First, I want to get to the premise. I guess there's no premise because it's too kind of well reported and kind of well thought to really have like the, some through line premise that I can do in a couple of seconds. But you know, certainly, you know, it speaks to this idea of, you know. The tour, the PGA Tour had for a very long time, and I, as someone that is, you know, as a golf outsider, even I saw them doing this. They put all of their eggs in the Tiger basket for this extreme period of time, and they didn't seem to have a backup plan. If theoretically speaking, which obviously I don't know how that could possibly happen, things somehow imploded on the Tiger front. So your book kind of looks at these at some of the young stars, the Bubba Watson, the Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson, some of these guys who have come up in kind of the wake of Tiger. Now, I'm curious about this. One thing I always wonder about, and this is, I wrote a piece about the Women's World Cup about this last week, about is someone like I talked to Allison Overholt, who runs ESPNW, is a big fan of, obviously an advocate of women's sports. And I asked her, like, do you want that big Brandi Chastain moment? Because on one hand, yeah, all right, more people are watching women's sports, more people are watching golf, in this example, to have someone to take over Tiger's, you know, throne, so on. But on the other hand, then it's kind of like the upworthy front page of Yahoo, Today Showization of our culture, which is the idea, like, if you love golf, I don't really care what other people think of it. Like, to me, if I was a huge golf fan, as exciting as Tiger was, you know, they, in a way, it would feel like this bastardization of my game. Like, oh, sure, you know Tiger, but do you know anybody else? No, so what kind of golf fan are you? To me, one of the best arguments your book makes is that there are so many compelling figures in golf right now that it's just a matter of getting people to pay attention to them. But do you lose something if they try to make some of these guys the crossover hits that maybe Tiger was?
Yeah, and I think that's the huge question that golf is facing right now, because we all know that individual sports like golf or tennis – kind of function better when either there's a rivalry between two or three guys, or when there's someone like Tiger Woods who's just dominating the sport. So right now, I mean, golf is really trying to sell Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, and Rory McIlroy as the next, you know, the next Tiger Woods in some sense. And of course, their resumes don't stack up to it as even close at this point in their careers, but they do. You know, I think personality is really important to them. But you're right, as someone who is a big golf fan, I'm sitting there going, listen, like, Dustin Johnson is so interesting. Patrick Reed, Jason Day, Bubba Watson. Like, there's so many. I could give you, like, 20 names of these guys that I think are really cool. But I think for the casual fan, which, let's be honest, golf is a niche sport. Right. And everybody is a casual fan, really, except for the 2% of wackos like me. For the casual fan, I think the reality is they need a figure like that. Like, you have no idea how many radio shows I'll go on in the next 2 weeks where every single question will be about Tiger Woods. Yeah, and I'll say, hey, I wrote a book about all these other guys.
Like, they, by definition, are not Tiger Woods. Like,
this is
what I did. Right.
But, you know, even with the title of my book, honestly, I mean, it's like putting Tiger Woods, and that's not why I did it. I think there's a really metaphorical side to my title, which is not only Tiger Woods fading at this point in his career, but like you pointed out, there was a Tiger bubble in golf. Everything was invested in this guy. And the question is, what happens? What happens when he's gone? How does anybody ever live up to the myth that is Tiger Woods and the fact that he was so incredibly successful? Now that we have so many great competitive young guys, it makes it actually more unlikely that any of them will ever reach that level again. So, yeah, to answer your question, I think you do need those personalities. But of course, a book like mine is trying to encourage people to sort of look at who these guys are, where they come from, and hopefully give people a little variety in that sense.
Yeah, and it's weird because, you know, when I look at golf, and you kind of look at golf's history, like, the thing you want to tell the industry of golf is that, like, Tiger was the aberration. Like, Tiger was the aberration. You are not actually that popular.
Like, yeah, that's so true. So true.
And it's weird that, like, there's this sense that, like, oh, we have to get back to what it was like at Tiger, but you're not going to. That was weird. That was a once in a life. You saw this a little bit with the NBA post-Jordan. They're like, wow, who's going to be the next Jordan? Well, there isn't one. because this was the bubble. This was the idea of it. But do you get a sense, having been around the tour for that long and having investigated this and been around, I want to ask you a little bit about the golfing press as well. But having been this invested in it, do you get a sense of the people that run golf or that are invested in golf or that have their business tied in this? Do they recognize that, or are they going to try to force these guys, Roy McIlroy and so on, to become a Tiger-like character?
They're always, I think, partly going to try to put these personalities at the forefront. But really, if you look at commercials for the PGA Tour, they're really trying to push this youth revolution angle as well. I think they're smart enough to know, and I actually had an interview with Tim Fincham, the commissioner of the PGA Tour. He's a really smart guy, and I think he knows that Tiger Woods, this is not going to happen again, or it's really unlikely that it'll happen again. If Rory McIlroy wins 14 majors, it'll be, it's not something anybody's predicting now, good as he is. So he kind of knows that. I think they really are trying to, it's not that they're going away from personalities, and it's not that they even necessarily shy away from this quote unquote next Tiger tag, because that kind of brings people into it. But I think they're casting a wider net. So I think they're intelligent in that way. But they still want Tiger to play. I mean, Tim Fincham told me that even if he never wins another tournament, but just keeps playing sort of at the level he is now, or once in a while he makes a cut, once in a great while he makes a top 15 but never wins, his influence will last a decade, just as a player. And so that's really, it just shows you what a huge figure he is.
But it's funny, too, because this is, my ballywick is baseball, and, I get very tired when people talk like it was funny. The MLB Network showed that they have the new StatCast thing, which shows all these cool things they're doing with baseball, and you can see baseball in this new way. But they had Bob Costas be the guy broadcasting it for the first game. So basically, he was like, "What? Listen, do these things mean anything if they can't tell us how Willie Mays would patrol the outfield?" And so those sort of things, right? So I wonder about this, and so it's led to this notion, to this idea, I think false, but it's led to this idea that baseball is somehow this old man's game, or this aging baby boomer game, which I don't think the facts bear that out, but certainly the perception is of that. And when you look at golf, and it's funny that I had a book come out a few years ago timed around this time of the year, specifically with the get out a few weeks before Father's Day.
Yeah, and then Father's Day.
Of course. And on one hand, that's great. That's awesome. Father's Day is a big book buying thing every year, because what the hell else do you? I'm not going to tell my dad any of my feelings.
He has enough flannel shirts.
Exactly. That said, I do think that, one of the things I was talking, I read the book and I thought, my wife's father's a big golf guy. I'm like, oh, I could get this guy, get him this for Father's Day. But then I realized I didn't know a lot of people my age that I would give this book to in a lot of ways. I mean, people that like good writing, but people that that aren't necessarily into books but are really into golf. I live in the South, so obviously there are a few of those, but on the whole, there is still this perception, I think, that golf is still an older man's game. And I wonder if that, A, if you think that's true, B, is that a financial thing? Is that a demographic thing? And three, are they working on, because to me, I read your book and I see all these young, exciting players. This feels like exactly the type of thing that you could market to maybe younger people.
Yeah, and it's a huge problem. You've nailed it. I think the average age of CBS broadcast on Sunday or Saturday of a major golf tournament is 60, 70 years old, which is an average age, which is insane.
To be fair, those people might just not be able to find the remote a couple of years ago.
They were watching Letterman on Tuesday night, and it's still there. So that's a big problem. And then, youth participation is going way down, and it's a financial thing partly. It's an attention span thing hugely. I only started playing golf myself 3 years ago because, when I was a kid, it was boring. I didn't want to play. I wanted to play baseball, basketball, football. So I started, and I got obsessed, and I got addicted, like happens so often because it is that kind of game. But if I go out on a weekend, I'm lucky to get around it in 5 hours, which is too long. Right. Even for me, even someone who loves the game, it's just too long to spend on a golf course. So they're doing a lot of things to try to sort of make it quicker or make it more fun. I mean, they're doing, like six-hole courses. They're trying to develop things like that. One thing that Tim Fincham told me was that in Korea and Japan, they now have these essentially like combination karaoke golf bars. So you can go and do karaoke and drink, and there's music, but also there's this sort of simulated golf where you can play a course on a screen. There's all these things that they're doing to try to make it cool that, you know, you and I would probably roll our eyes at. You know, it's like, it doesn't seem like it would be that effective, but, you know, they certainly identify the problem. They're trying to, like, some places are making the holes bigger, which is crazy. So they know the problem. They absolutely do. The solution is much harder. It's really, really hard to know how to build this. There's organizations like the First Tee that are trying to bring it to, to impoverished kids and things like that. But, yeah, it's an uphill battle. I mean, it's how do you get people into golf? How do you tell a kid to like golf? You know, it's not an easy answer at all.
Yeah, Japan and Korea are always ahead of us and correct on this stuff, though. Like, it's worth it. I remember, like, 10 years ago, like, someone told me, 10 or 11 years ago, someone had just swept from back from Japan, and they're like, literally, at the dinner table, all they do is just sit and look at their phones. And I was like, oh, my God! What kind of world is that? What's wrong with those people?
And, they've got it. They've got it.
They always end up being right. It's funny, one of the things, you know, I'm curious, when you went into this and kind of like walking away now, who is the character, regardless of who is maybe winning the most or who's the ones being marketed the most, or, you know, who's the ones that your headline guy, so on, who is the one that you came away from, either you talked to or talked stories about, or the stories you read about in this book? Who's the character that you came across thinking like, okay, more people need to know about this guy in this story? When you went back from your notes and everything, whose story were you most excited to sit down and start typing out?
So there's two things there. There's two answers, because there's stories of where a person comes from, which is interesting. And then there's who has the best personality, who would I enjoy talking to the most. So for the second question, can we swear on this podcast?
Oh, of course.
Okay, so yeah. I talked to this golfer named Matt Every, who I wrote a chapter about. And, well, when I turned this book in, it was 800 pages long when I turned the first draft in. And we had to cut it to 400 pages. So any, like, even semi-minor golfer got cut, and he's like the one I refused to cut because I like him so much, and I thought the chapter was funny. And actually, by the time this podcast comes out, that excerpt will be up on golf.com if people want to check it out. But anyway, one of the first things, we were talking, and I asked him if he felt lucky, and I clarified that and said, when I say lucky, I don't mean, oh, I'm so lucky to be here, but just that you've been cosmically lucky or something. And he said, he's like, I'm glad you said that, because I'm fucking sick to death of people acting like I won a fucking lottery. He's like, I worked my fucking ass off to be here. Yeah. And when you're used to talking to golfers and how careful they are and how unbelievably circumspect and scared of the media they are, this was like, yeah. I mean, this was just a normal conversation between two people, but it felt like I just got Obama to, you know, tell me all about his childhood or something. It was it was ridiculous. It was great. And we laughed. And one thing I wrote in the book is I came away thinking, like, holy shit, this is a guy who I could be friends with. And that was so far from my mind with anybody else I met on tour. So he's a really cool guy that people should kind of follow. He his most infamous moment was he got caught smoking weed and suspended a couple years ago. So that's Matt Every. But he's won at Bay Hill 2 years in a row. But then to answer the part of where people come from, there's a golfer named Jason Day, who I think is number 6 in the world right now, from Australia. And he comes from... Will, as you know, especially where you live, the majority of American golfers come from wealthy backgrounds, either right. In California, the Southeast, Texas, places like that.
Yeah, not Central Illinois.
No, exactly. Not upstate New York either. Although Keegan Bradley comes from Vermont. But anyway, so you know, people, you need a little bit of money to play golf. But in Australia, it's a little cheaper. And it made for this story with Jason Day, which is this ultimate long shot, where his family was so poor that... here's how we got his first golf club. They would sometimes forage at the town dump for toys for the kids, for supplies for the house, because they had nothing. Both his parents worked at a meatworks, and his dad actually, in one of these sort of rubbish trips, found an old rotting three wood, brought it home to Jason Day, who was 3 years old at the time, and he would hit a tennis ball back and forth with it. And, you know, that's how he got started with golf. And it only costs $100 to play at their local, you know, quote-unquote country club, which they call it there. It's nothing like our country clubs. But then he went through, I mean, Jason Day was an alcoholic when he was 12 years old. His dad died of stomach cancer. Sister ran away from home. And, you know, finally his mom mortgaged their home to send him to a golf academy as sort of a last-ditch effort to get his life on track and give him a chance. And from there, he's gone to be one of the best golfers in the world. So it's this outstanding story that's could never happen in America, and it you can't help but like him when you hear it.
Is that a bad thing that stories like that are really hard to happen in America? The idea that it's funny because you know I've played golf. You know I feel bad saying this because you just wrote this really great book about golf, but I have a wager, a three-figure wager with Tommy Craggs, of when I left New York. I've been in Athens 2 years. And I have a three-figure wager because, you know, we roll big online.
Mm-hmm.
Over the next 5 years, I won't play golf more than five times. And because he was convinced, you know, Craggs, he was convinced, you know, he's a communist. So Craggs was convinced that I was going to come to the South and just become and wear nothing but polo shirts and khakis and play golf all the time. And which it's fine, you know. But my point is because Craig's, like me, has this kind of inherent, perhaps unfair, notion of golf as this game that was not something that was on our radar by design growing up. Like, that's not, like, there was never been no place. Like, golf was, like, there were some people that can't escape golf growing up, and there are some people that wouldn't even know that golf was a possibility growing up. Does that hurt the game? Is that something that they're working on?
Yeah, it definitely hurts the game, and it's too bad in some ways because even though, you know, you and Craggs might laugh at me for saying this, golf can be a very democratic game when you're looking at the local municipal level. So, for example, if I wanted to go play on a weekday, it would cost me like $10 at this muni course where I play. And I'm not the kind of person who would ever pay $50 to play a round of golf, much less $200 at a great course. It's just not something I would do. I think it's a waste of money, and I agree with you guys there, but it doesn't have to be this ritzy game associated with douchebags, you know. Like, it doesn't have to, and often it's not. And but I think you're right. I think there's a perception of that not only is it a rich game, but it's a white game. You know, I think that's a big thing. And yeah, the PGA Tour. I mean, with these programs like the First Tee, that's a huge focus for them. But it's an uphill battle because of the perception. But I think more because of the money involved. I just don't think it's anything that. Even golf at the cheapest levels is, you know, obviously far more expensive than having a soccer ball or a basketball and a net. You know, it's just there's no comparison. It's, you know, it's like a game like lacrosse almost. You know, it's, you're going to get a very specific demographic playing it. I don't think it has to be true for golf, and hopefully it won't be true in the future. But I don't know how much headway they're making, and it just seems like one of those problems to me that's going to keep getting worse.
How open has the tour? We saw this recently with Stephanie Wee, kind of getting her credentials pulled for periscoping, which is, I have literally no idea what that is, but it's a verb now.
Yeah.
And so I'm assuming it wasn't like something terrible she was doing. But no, I know she
was literally spying on the locker room with a periscope from underneath the floor.
I don't even actually know how she had access to a submarine in the
floor. Yeah, amazing.
So certainly, you know, there's a sense, I think, that somehow even the world of golf and even the golfing press a little bit is this older kind of group that's not, you know, that's not maybe in touch with the way that media is working now or the way people consumers consume this stuff in a lot of ways. You know, you write for Granlund, you write for, you know, cool, hip media place. Were you welcomed well? Do you see that? Was regardless of the specifics of Stephanie's case, do you see that warming up a little bit, or is that something they're maybe behind other sports in?
Yeah, and you're talking about the media now, like the relations between the older media and the younger media?
And the sports kind of relationship with new media in general, I guess.
Yeah, so I think there is a lot of suspicion from the PGA Tour to certain younger journalists. But on the other hand, the PGA Tour really facilitated my access throughout the year. And actually, you know, and it's again, sometimes you see this generational divide between the older journalists and the younger journalists. And I think there's a lot of older journalists who would say they don't like Stephanie and have a real problem with what she does. I didn't find that as much, probably because I'm not putting things out on a daily basis. I wasn't like a blogger who was, right. You know, putting, and I didn't like, you know, tweet a ton about golf or anything. And so I guess I sort of behaved more like an older journalist, even though I wasn't going around kissing boot heels or anything. But eventually people, I'm kind of quiet when I'm out, you know, somewhere new before I kind of, you know, see the lay of the land. So maybe that made it a little bit easier for me. And I actually had, you know, I had great support from guys like Doug Ferguson, who is an AP writer, Jim McCabe, who's a Boston Globe writer. So I have no complaints about that. But I do think, just like any media, there's a little bit of resentment coming down. I saw one writer the other day on Twitter. There's a guy named Kyle Porter, who is the CBS Golf. Mm-hmm. Right, he's their main writer. CBS Golf is just a blog at this point. They send him to one tournament a year, which is the Byron Nelson, which is outside his backyard because he lives in Dallas. And he does the best he can with what he's got. But, you know, he's a great writer, but there's no access. You know, he's not going to be out on tour because the money's not there. And then some writer took him to task, one of these veteran writers, compared a story that Bob Herrig of ESPN wrote, and then compare it to Kyle's and called it like a steaming pile of shit. And Kyle's was like just a typical blog post. It was very tongue-in-cheek. It was funny. It was about Tiger Woods' swing changes and how he said that, you know, he's learning from his son because his son doesn't think too much. Or, you know, something so, like a throwaway blog post that you have to do sometimes. Yep. And, yeah, it was funny because he was like this older writer was targeting Kyle. And I'm thinking, like, fine, if you don't like that style of writing, target the style of writing. But it's not like Kyle is choosing not to go to tournaments, okay? We live in a different environment. We live in a place where there's less money. And, you know, they can't send us out. And it's just so funny when people who have had, you know, I guess a little more privilege on the journalistic side than we have get angry almost. It's like, hey, you can't go to tournaments, so I'm pissed off at you. It's like, hey, you're looking at the wrong target, man.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, and I don't want to get into too much. I think there's an argument to be made on both sides about the specifics of the Periscope thing with Stephanie, because I do actually know what Periscoping is. I'm just being dumb. So I think but certainly, you know, the work that she's done and bringing a new kind of side and a new way of covering golf, to me, I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, of people that I, you know, people that I follow on Twitter and people that, you know, the people that I tend to just read casually, they all read her stuff all the time. And it was certainly a new way of kind of covering golf in a way that they weren't used to. Is it a bad sign for golf that she tries this experiment of doing something new and ends up kind of ruffling so many feathers?
A little bit, but then you also have to notice that the PGA Tour social media team started Periscoping like the next week.
Of course.
And I'm friends with some of the guys on that team, like DJ Pihowski. They do a great job, and they're actually, you know, they're pretty savvy, and they're really pushing the envelope as much as they can at the PGA Tour. So I think there was a little bit of the PGA Tour. It was maybe less of we hate young people and young things, and more like we're protecting our property and we're going to do that. So we're not going to let you do it. And you know, and Stephanie, like you said, there's two sides. I mean, I love Stephanie and I love her coverage, but she pushes the envelope. Yeah. Now, I think the PGA Tour was foolish as hell to come down on her like this because they made themselves look so bad. But, you know, Stephanie tweaked them on purpose, I think, to a certain extent. And, you know, you poke the bear enough times, and sometimes the bear kind of bites back.
When the bear has billions of dollars, based on television, nothing scarier than a rich bear.
Absolutely.
One thing I want to ask you about before only a couple more things. Certainly, getting back to the process of writing the book, you had something that's always it's always a little scary to have happen when you're working on a project like this. Because as you said, this book was originally 800 pages. Now it's into 400 pages. It's very readable. Sometimes people hear 800 and then they hear 400. They get very scared. This is a very readable book. It's not a difficult book to read at all. It's not, you know, there's not Foster Wallace 800 pages of footnotes at the end. Or Grantland, I guess, pages of footnotes at the end. But certainly, you know, it's a strange thing that, like, because you do all this work and you put all this book together, and there's still gonna be is that that Patrick Reed book?
Right.
And I've read the whole section. I think a lot of people have read the whole section. I think there, I think because of some of his clumsiness and maybe some of, like, frankly, the lack of inquisitiveness some people had in the wake of some of his reactions to the excerpt that was posted, I think there's this sense that you're like, oh, this is the one where he shows that Patrick Reed's a jerk and I hate this guy. And I don't really find that the case from what you wrote at all. Certainly, I think you call out some things that probably should be called out. But I think it definitely comes across, I think even from what we've talked about here, Reed is a fascinating guy that that I think brings a lot of energy to the tour.
Yeah, and I think the people, a lot of people that said to me, you know, I came away from this hearing all about Patrick Reed's past and all the accusations and everything like that, and I kind of still like him, or I still appreciate him, yeah. And I like that. I mean, that showed me that you know that they were really reading and paying attention.
Right,
yeah, exactly. Because you said a lack of inquisitiveness after he comes back, and you know it's so funny how eager people are to side with a billionaire over a poor writer, right. Like you know like I'm
yeah,
the bad
but, guy. But yeah, you're the one trying to get rich. That's my favorite thing about books. Oh, maybe you could sell some more books by. Whatever, that going after the billionaires.
Yeah, I would be on Wall Street, right? Yeah, I would be in an investment bank if money was my big thing. But yeah, no, he, you know, he's, like you said, he's a fascinating guy. And I keep saying this ad nauseum. I don't know how much of a difference it'll make, but I really enjoy talking to him when I did. Yeah. The interview we had, I thought he was a great storyteller. He's got an intensity about him that is really interesting. And, you know, interesting personalities are sometimes in short supply on the PGA Tour. I was lucky enough to find a bunch of them, and they're the ones that make up this book. And it's why I think hopefully, you know, people like the book, because it's going to show these guys for what they really are. You know, Ricky Fowler is not just a guy who wears an orange outfit. You know, I mean, he comes from a certain place. He's got a great backstory. He's all that. And Patrick Reed's the same. But you know what? There are shades of gray in all of these guys and all of us. And I think it might be a product a little bit, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but I think sports media and especially golf media a little more have a tendency to do these whitewash sort of hagiographies of players where they, you know, and especially true on TV, where they try to make them out to be saints. And I'm not trying to do that to anybody. I'm not trying to demonize anybody, but I'm also not ignoring that stuff, and I'm not going to keep it out of my book. And that's just – It sounds crazy to say, but that might be a little different in golf. It might be not revolutionary, but uncommon for sure.
All right, so last question here, because you know, one of the things I like about the book too is there's always going to be interesting people on the PGA Tour, and you know, I would love. Did you have a good enough experience doing this, regardless of how the book sells? Because it will sell great, and everything will be wonderful, and you will be able to retire in a month.
Perfect.
And then just toss $100 bills at all the people clearing out of your way as you walk down the street. But certainly, did you have a good enough experience? Would you be interested in profiling people 10 years from now, the next realm of this? Did you feel like you got enough excitement and enough thrill from this to do it again, or do you feel like this is a specific group of people that maybe is as exciting as maybe you're going to see for a while?
No, I really, really enjoyed covering golf, and there's something about covering it live. You can get closer than any other sport when they're actually playing. And you know, you get to know these guys to a certain extent, and I just think it's so cool that kind of access you can have, and I love taking advantage of that. Now I have the kind of personality where I kind of like to hop from project to project, so I'm not guaranteeing that I'll keep covering golf very long or I'll write another golf book, but you know, now I write for Golf Digest and I'm writing for Golf World in the UK, and I'm doing things like that, and you know, I would love to keep doing it. I'm going to all the majors this year. I really like the golf scene, you know, for all its warts and all, it's really cool to me. So yeah, hopefully. I'm not saying I'm going to be a lifer like Dan Jenkins or something, but I enjoy it. And I hope people aren't so mad at me that it makes it impossible for that to happen. this book.
I think you'll be all right. Well, Shane, you are, as I've mentioned this to you before, I think in private, you are a man after my own heart, someone that is productive and smart and what writes about golf, writes about television, writes about college basketball, does not, as someone that gets yelled every time, why is this guy writing about movies? Who's this guy? Why is he writing about Hillary Clinton? For me, you're, you know, the idea that in this vast, huge spectrum of places where we can all be published, the idea that we'd only be able to write about one thing has always struck me as very strange. So I'm a big fan of your work, not just in golf, and this is a terrific book, and congratulations. You should be very proud.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think we're Renaissance men. I don't think that's too big. Of course, I'm kidding. But no, thank you. No, I really appreciate that. And of course, I admire you. And for folks who don't know, Will, you know, read a little bit of this book before it went out and gave me great advice. And
yeah, you've always been in the part that got cut.
I know. But again, 800 pages. You know, you
can't... No, please. I felt a little bad until you're like, no, we had to cut this thing in half. I'm like, oh, got it. No worries.
Exactly. No, but you've been a little bit of a mentor to me, I think, you know, in whatever way is possible in this crazy digital world. So thank you as well.
Oh, man. Well, seriously, great work. And so now we're going to hang out. We'll finish up here, and then we'll do trivia, and then you can be and play that game. But mostly, everyone, thank you for coming on. And this has been really fun. And seriously, good luck with the book.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you to Shane Ryan. That's him. He can still hear me. I'm talking already like he's not here. But he can, in fact, hear what I'm saying. But nevertheless, go get his book. He's at bookstores everywhere now. You can also get it on Amazon or Less Evil Booksellers. The book is Slaying the Tiger. Get it everywhere where books are sold. And who knows, if Shane is anything like me, when my first book that was at least wide enough scale to get into bookstores, you may actually see him there picking up copies of the books and taking them from whatever shelf they were on to the shelf that has the Insurgent Divergent books and then just putting it on top of those.
That's great.
Mine was A Million Little Pieces. I think I put that back when James Frey was a thing. But
I'm going to do the new 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be right next to Slaying the Tiger.
Exactly. All right, so thank you, Shane Ryan. Everyone go get the book. You can also follow him on Twitter at Shane Ryan Here, ShaneRyanHere. This has been the Willie's Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We'll be back tomorrow or the next day to do the trivia podcast that Shane is about to do with me right now. Be safe out there.